Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and this is Between the Covers. Last week, we met Jillian Mackin, a woman who's out to reinvent herself by investing in a very exclusive dairy in Ireland. So exclusive, in fact, that she had to be blindfolded on the way to the farm so she couldn't reveal its location. The story is called Pope's Own, which is the name of the cheese, and it's written by Vancouver author Timothy Taylor. In tonight's episode, Jillian finally unearths the secrets behind both the running of the farm and the cheese itself.
She followed Fergal around the next day, squelching behind him in a too big pair of Clooney's wellies. They took morning milk from half the herd and poured it steaming, still warm from the cows, into the table vats with the rennet. When it firmed into curds, these were lightly cut with long, thin knives, drained, then pressed gently into the triangular molds, filling each of them up halfway. "All right, then," Fergal said. "You'll want to watch this part." The gowned woman who was working with them produced a steel pail of purple paste. Jillian's eyebrows raised quizzically, but the woman said nothing. Fergal answered, "Soot and port wine to protect the surface." "Soot?" Jillian asked. "As in ashes?" He nodded, concentrating as the woman gently brushed the surface of the curds in the half-filled molds. They repeated the process with a late afternoon milking from the other half of the herd. After these curds were cut and drained, they were used to fill the molds to the top, trapping the layer of purple ash in the center. "After about a week, we salt them and transfer them to the curing house," Fergal explained. "We'll wash the rinds with brine and brandy for a few weeks until they're nice and orange." At the end of the second day, she walked back through the brothers' pastures again, alone this time, and stood on the ridge line looking down at the farm. The cows had been released into the fields after the second milking. The 7 employees from nearby towns were pulling out the front drive, driving slowly over the cattle guard. She could pick out Fergal, making his final rounds before shaking hands with Clooney at the front door and climbing into his small flatbed truck. Above her, the darkness was coming, dropping down to enfold this farm and her. And she felt herself snugged down by the descending night, pinched between the air and the land, and fused between them. She called Tremblay after dinner from the old black-and-chrome phone in the main floor study. He was in an upbeat mood, the Dublin numbers having come back very high. "Bit of interest in West Cork at the moment," he said. "I'm afraid prices reflect it." He told her. It was about twice what Jillian expected. She winced and looked out through the glass into the darkness. Her own reflection was superimposed over the silhouette of the ridgeline, where the stars were just visible. "You tried," Tremblay said. "That's the important thing."
"You think so?" Jillian said.
"But to a degree, yes."
"To what degree, though?" Jillian asked. The comment angered her. "Jillian, I want to know to what degree trying is the important thing. Is trying about half the value of doing something? Is it about a quarter of the value?"
Tremblay listened patiently at the other end of the phone.
"Because I'm more of the opinion at the moment, Tremblay, that it's about 0% of the value."
"Fine," Tremblay said.
"Tell me where the money comes from and I'll get it to you." "I could sell the property up the valley," she said.
"Bad idea," Tremblay said.
"But it wouldn't be enough anyway."
"Bad idea?" Jillian said, gripping the phone tighter.
"What do you mean, bad idea?
Investing everything in Irish real estate? Is this the strategy we discussed? Anyway, it's not enough.
Sell the West End condo."
"You have to live somewhere."
"I realize that," she said. "I could live here."
"Jillian," he tried, "I think you're getting ahead of yourself.
You have no idea where I am relative to myself," she said, irritated with this resistance.
Always accommodating, always deferring to her, he chose this moment to carve a position on something.
"I won't help you run away,"
Tremblay was saying.
He might well have said more after this, but those words obliterated whatever might have followed. "Run away," she said, incredulous. "I know what's going on," Tremblay said. "What this really means, he was a bastard. All right, the world agrees that he was a bastard, that he deserves to fail, to be surpassed by you, for you to succeed." "You are completely wrong," Julian said. "I'm not," Tremblay said firmly. "You're falling for the oldest impulse in the book, flight. It's no more complicated than that, really. You're going to run until nothing looks like the same anymore, and then you'll think you've proved to yourself somehow that you've changed, gone past him. But you won't have." "Nonsense," Julian said. They were both still on the line, and seconds passed during which explanations might have been attempted, but all she could think of were the obstacles erecting themselves between her and what she had finally found. And as the thought surged, her hand slammed the phone down into the old chrome cradle. "Just don't be angry," Chekhov had said. "For yourself, don't be angry." "How can I not be angry? Everything should be wiped clean just because he's buying $58 worth of expensive cheese he probably doesn't even eat. Makes me sick to look at him." "That's what groveling looks like. I'm not suggesting you forgive David, only don't spoil it for yourself by being angry." He answered on the first ring. She didn't even say hello. "What are you painting these days?" she asked him. "Cheese," David said. Then he laughed unnecessarily hard, his voice cracking with the manic pleasure of hearing from her. She supposed he might be thinking of a sunny future just then, a post-marital uber-contentment during which he and his darling ex-wife would share friendly, absolving banter over coffee. So ran the purple vein of her insight as she clutched the phone in the study of Brother's house just then. "I need to borrow money," she said. She told him every detail, more than he wanted to know, no doubt, but she left him not one spare second to interrupt. She laid everything bare for this man who had himself a proclivity for laying things bare, not caring. She told him about the farm up the valley, about the condo in town, the price of McGugan's cheese shop, the value of the inventory. She told him about Chekhov's tip, about Brothers, about the morning milking and the evening milking, and the port-stained ash between, about the cobblestones on the main drive, the tended gardens, Annie, and the women in their hairnets, about the sky pressing down on her like a lover on the ridge that evening, how it had pinched her to the earth and made her blood prickle in her veins, about, at the end of it all, what she had discovered and what, through her, it could become. She wrote up the offer immediately after hanging up. And when she was finished, she didn't think about anybody. Not about David, or Tremblay, or Clooney. Not even about Chekhov. She walked the envelope down the hall to the last door on the right, and slid it under into the darkness beyond. Jillian heard the front gate opening early the next morning as a courier from Dublin dropped off the other envelope. But she didn't want to see Clooney until he had decided. She didn't want to see Clooney comparing her to some anonymous other. She walked through the dairy instead, watching the women cutting the morning curds with their long, tined knives. She watched the whole process as it unfolded again, thinking with pleasure of this gentle and perpetual repetition. "What's your name?" she asked the woman who had applied the purple soot the day before. Now she was raking the curds silently.
"Sal,"
she said. They met in the front room as agreed. The sun streamed in off the meadow behind him. "You were low," Clooney said. She nodded, but couldn't bring herself to comprehend these words. "Low? How?" she said. Clooney sighed. "Lower than Dublin," he explained. Over Clooney's shoulder, she could see that the cattle had been released into the main pasture behind the house.
I don't believe this, she said. How close?
Does it matter? Clooney said. I have a duty.
How close, goddammit, she asked.
Clooney stared at her, a little sorrowfully. I'm sorry, she said.
So am I, he answered. She sat back in her chair, exhaled a long breath. Who is Dublin? Who is this winner of Brothers Farm? Maybe I could talk to him.
Jillian, he said, the first time he'd used her first name.
Do you think I'd lie to you?
She snapped at him. The man she needed in the whole process, the key to this whole thing, and she snapped.
I don't take this personally, she said,
sharp, voice raised.
Oh, no,
he said.
You're a bit like your friend Brian McGugan in that department, I think.
She had to think who that was for a moment. Chekhov. And then her mind was spinning forward already. Who is the other bidder? She asked. Clooney squinted and thought.
You can afford to tell me now, surely, she said.
He scratched the side of his jaw.
Coleman McGugan, he said.
She considered this, recalibrating her view of the situation.
Chekhov's brother,
she said eventually.
The elder of the two,
Clooney said.
McGugan, the father, willed Brothers Farm to the church some 30 years ago. It was to go back to one of the boys at a fair market price, if ever one of them did wish to buy it. One of the boys, that is, or a designate.
And you set them bidding against one another?
The McGugan boys were born to bid against each other, Clooney said. The surprising thing is that Chekhov didn't come himself. He must think very highly of you to send you along instead.
This is ridiculous, Jillian said.
You might say so.
And while Clooney sat there, comfortable in his chair, his index finger dipped unconsciously into his vest pocket. So instinctive was this impulse to reach for strength beyond. She didn't care that it was muscle memory at this point. She cared only that it was a telegraph.
How dare this man, anyone for that matter, come wading in on her with a left hand at the waist, chin dangling?
Clooney rose slowly to his full height, lanky at 50.
You haven't passed the news along yet, she said, setting up.
I wanted to tell you first. The brothers, Jillian went on, keeping her eyes steadily on a spot in the middle of Clooney's chest. I mean, the McGugan brothers. They're not believers, are they?
Oh, we're all believers in our own way, I suppose, Clooney said.
That's not so at all, she said.
Not true of Chekhov. Not true of Coleman McGugan either. Chekhov is a bitter ex-communist Republican, and Coleman is a successful businessman with his treasure stored up on Earth. Isn't that true?
Clooney appraised the comment.
Perhaps. You think either of them understands Matthew 13:45?
Jillian said.
And only now she let her eyes drift downwards, intending to play-act sorrow, and finding it right there, quite real in her throat and behind her chest. Although she could no longer see him, she could hear that Clooney had stopped moving.
Or again, Jillian said, and her cheeks flushed just a little, as it occurred to her she might forget the verse, and she had to blot everything out briefly. The sound of the breeze, of cattle, the smell of straw and clover, of manure, the light of the country streaming in around them. She imagined herself channeling the scripture itself, and the words then came easily. Or again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant searching for fine pearls. When he has found a single pearl of great value, he goes and sells all his possessions and buys it. You can hear someone listening. As she thought back, Jillian knew she had never, ever heard David or Trombley or even Chekhov
listened to her as Clooney listened to her that day. He listened so hard. Listened with everything in him to everything in her.
Bridget O'Sullivan read Pope's Own by Timothy Taylor. It's from his collection of short stories called Silent Cruise, published by Vintage Canada. Tomorrow, we begin a quartet of stories by Stephen Hyten called To Everything There Is a Season. Now I have another take on desire. It's on a seasonal note and from a youthful perspective. For many young children, part of the thrill of this time of year is anticipating what present will be waiting under the tree on Christmas morning. Heather Spears recalls her own pre-holiday excitement as a child in her poem, Bluebell. It's read by Kristen Thomas.
Bluebell. The great china doll, not to be touched, waits in the attic. Her eyes are mild. They click shut. There's a faint dust smell on her. When I'm 8, I'm to get her. One night near Christmas, I stare from the downstairs hall. The furniture's pulled back and the skirting's propped, lined with small dresses, gowns, coats, boots. Bluebell. And only much slower will the rest reach me. My sister, my mother, their high laps brimmed with needles and bright cloth under the lamps. Close-lipped, caught, kind. I'll take Bluebell to school. They warn me she'll break, but it's me who's fragile. No one ever had such a doll, so clear and imperious. I can only pretend she is mine. She is no one's.
Kristen Thomas reading Bluebell, a poem written by Heather Spears. She's a poet and visual artist who divides her time between Vancouver and Denmark. The poem is from her collection, How to Read Faces, published by Woolsack and Wynn. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that the Between the Covers collection of audiobooks is available on CD and on cassette. Selected readings from past seasons of Between the Covers are available through Goose Lane Editions. For more information and to order, you can call this number toll-free, 1-888-926-8377. That's 1-888-9-COVERS. And that's all for this evening. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late-night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights.